Found after their boat capsized off the coast of Libya early Friday morning. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Migration Agency says 10 bodies reportedly have washed up on Libyan shores, 2 Libyans and 8 Pakistani nationals. The agency says information about this latest tragedy is still sketchy, and an investigation is underway. IOM spokeswoman Olivia Hayden is in Tunisia monitoring the situation. Speaking by telephone from the capital, Tunis, she tells VOA the migrants apparently were making the fatal journey on an overcrowded smuggler's boat. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
2 people were killed on Friday after a barrage of rockets were fired at 2 border towns in Turkey from the Syrian-Kurdish enclave of Afrin across the border. The Haiti governor's office issued a statement saying that at least 6 rockets were targeted to the town of Rehanli, damaging a home, workplace, and a road close to the marketplace, wounding 18 people, 2 of whom later died in a hospital. Cambodia's cabinet on Friday endorsed an amendment to the criminal code making insulting the king a criminal offense, punishable by a fine and up to 5 years in prison. From Washington, I'm Steve Miller, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
in Kenya, tensions between the government and the opposition continue to climb in the wake of Raila Odinga's self-inauguration Tuesday as a so-called People's President. On Friday, authorities arrested another of Odinga's allies, sparking protests in some parts of the capital. Meanwhile, the government continues to defy a court order to lift a ban on 3 independent media organizations.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. We'll have the latest from Kenya coming up.
Also, French President Emmanuel Macron and Senegal's President Macky Sall met today ahead of a global gathering on education in Dakar. And the UN warns the situation in South Sudan is getting worse as conflict has displaced a third of the population.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: in Kenya, tensions between the government and the opposition continue to climb in the wake of Raila Odinga's self-inauguration Tuesday as the so-called People's President. Today, authorities arrested another of Odinga's allies, sparking protest in some parts of the capital. Meanwhile, the government continues to defy a court order to lift a ban on 3 independent media organizations. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenya's 3 largest broadcasters remained off the air for a 4th day Friday despite the High Court ruling the day before that the government must reverse the suspension. Authorities cut transmission for the media outlets Tuesday as they prepared live coverage of the opposition swearing-in event. The Kenyan human rights activist behind the legal challenge, Okia Omtata, attempted to serve the court papers to the government's communications authority Friday. Omtata spoke to VOA about what happened next.
I was personally marked and I was not allowed past the gate. I was told I had instructions from above not to allow me past the gate, nor to allow the court order to be served. So what I did is I pinned it on the wall, a copy of the order, but they ripped it off.
Omtata said he has no choice but to bring the matter back to the court Monday.
Well, the only clarifies issues for me now. I now know that what we are dealing with is not a failure to comprehend the law, but a deliberate move by the government to violate the Bill of Rights and the Constitution of Kenya and to operate outside the confines of the law.
The Communications Authority has not commented on the ban. Omtata told VOA he was able to serve the remaining court papers addressed to the Attorney General, Interior Minister and Minister of Information, Communication and Technology. The ruling Jubilee administration accuses the media of failing to heed its advice not to air Tuesday's opposition swearing-in. In a statement released Wednesday, the day before the High Court's ruling, Interior Minister Fred Matiang'i said the stations will remain shut throughout ongoing investigations into alleged complicity in what he called an effort to subvert the government and spark violence. Odinga has refused to accept the results of an October presidential runoff, which he boycotted. Incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta was declared the winner. In a statement Thursday, the U.S. State Department expressed grave concern over both Odinga's self-integration and what U.S. officials called the government's action to shut down, intimidate and restrict the media. Murithi Mutiga, the International Crisis Group's Kenya researcher, says a spat between the Kenyatta administration and the media will go on.
He came into office seeming to have an axe to grind with key elements of society, including the media and civil society, and that has continued and persisted. We've seen media houses being denied advertising, which is a crucial source of revenue. We've seen continued attempts to legislate against the media. So I think it will continue. There will continue to be push and pull between the administration and the media.
President Kenyatta gave a televised speech at the Kenya School of Government Friday. At the end, he gestured to the journalists and spoke in Swahili.
Sasa si nyinyi mzime hiyo mavitu yenu na muende. Kazi imekwisha.
Now, why don't you switch off your things, pack and go? Your work is over, he said. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
French President Emmanuel Macron and Senegal's President Macky Sall met today ahead of a global gathering on education in Dakar. Macron is on his sixth visit to Africa since taking office last year. Journalist Sophia Christensen is covering his visit to Dakar, and she spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson today.
So the purpose of Macron's visit is to strengthen the ties between France and Senegal. So this morning he was welcomed by Senegal's President Macky Sall in the palace, and they signed first a contract announcing the creation of a new Franco-Senegalese university campus and also a new agreement facilitating volunteering exchanges between France and Senegal. And they also finalized a loan by the EU and the French Development Agency for water and sanitation programs and a contract for the installation of 50,000 off-grid solar panels in Senegal. The two presidents then visited the popular Dakar neighborhood of Han to inaugurate one of 17 new middle schools opened by the Senegalese government. And Macron is now taking part in a high-level panel on education at the GP conference this afternoon, and he will be in the northern town of Saint-Louis tomorrow to discuss climate change.
This is the President Macron's sixth visit to Africa since he took office last year. How is he viewed in Senegal?
So the streets of Dakar were lined with cheering supporters this morning, and people in the crowd said they felt honored by the president's visit, and they viewed this as an important moment for Senegal. Macron has said many times, and the most recent in a speech to students in the University of Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso, that he wants to create a new dynamic between Europe and Africa. And Macron himself does not seem to be an unpopular figure here, but of course, like in many African countries, there is also a lot of resentment towards France as a former colonial power and the influence the country still seems to have on its former colonies. And there are a handful of small but passionate movements in Senegal demanding an end to what they see as French neocolonialism, and they have been very open and vocal about their discontent with Macron's visit.
Mr. Macron and Mr. Sall will be at the conference sponsored by the Global Partnership on Education today. What is the goal of the conference, and how do most African countries stand in terms of meeting educational goals?
So the aim of this conference today is to attract funding for education in developing countries, from primary school all the way up to university level. It is attended by seven African heads of state, high-level representatives from donor countries, international organizations, NGOs, and rumor has it that pop star Rihanna will also be attending as the ambassador for the GPE. The aim is to raise over $3 billion by 2020 to finance education in developing countries. And France is expected to cover up to 10% of this target. In Africa, there has been a remarkable improvement on providing education. But despite this, the continent remains the continent with the highest rates of exclusion. And in sub-Saharan Africa alone, over a fifth of children between the ages of 6 and 11 are out of school, and half of these are girls. So many challenges are still ahead, particularly as Africa is facing a demographic boom that will put even more pressure on its existing education structures.
That was journalist Sophia Christensen in Dakar speaking with Kate Pound-Dawson.
At least 90 migrants are reported to have drowned when a boat capsized off the coast of Libya this morning. The International Organization for Migration spokesperson Olivia Hedon says 10 bodies are reported to have washed up on Libyan shores. The dead include 2 Libyans and 8 Pakistani nationals. IOM is working to get more details of the latest tragedy on the Mediterranean Sea. The deaths come as the organization released its latest figures on migrant arrivals in Europe. I spoke with reporter Josephine McKenna about the boat incident and IOM's migrant figures.
The International Organization for Migration says at least 90 migrants are reported to have drowned when a boat capsized off the coast of Libya today. Now, this is very distressing news, and the UN body said that 10 bodies are reported to have washed up on Libyan shores near the town of Zawara. 8 of the dead were Pakistani and 2 Libyan, but the organization is trying to get more details of the tragedy and find out exactly what happened to the others and hopefully identify which countries they came from.
Do you think this is another trend regarding migrants in terms of these being Pakistanis?
Well, it's interesting to see that in this particular case, there were many Pakistanis among the victims, at least 2 Libyans, and we had 2 survivors also swim ashore, by the way. But there has been a recent increase in the number of Pakistanis trying to make these boat crossings from Libya towards Italy. And it's not clear whether those victims that we saw today were Pakistanis living in Libya or simply transitioning through Libya in order to make their way to Europe. Now, last year, 3,100 Pakistanis reached Italy by sea, making them the 13th largest nationality among migrants. And the IOM is also concerned that trafficking networks are very quick to try and identify new markets, new routes, and new nationalities in what is continuing to be a very highly fluid situation, and trying to sell migrants the idea of Europe as a kind of paradise. This is of concern. Of course, we're still seeing many numbers of sub-Saharan African migrants trying to make that crossing as well. But we're not sure how many of those may have been among the latest victims of this tragedy.
Also, the IOM has released some recent numbers regarding migrants. What are they saying?
We had around 6,600 people crossing the Mediterranean just in January this year. About two-thirds of those, around 4,200, arrived in Italy. That's a 10% increase from the previous year in 2017. And unfortunately, about 250 people are believed to have died while making that crossing in January. So still a great concern seeing the number of victims who are losing their lives making this very dangerous journey across the Mediterranean.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehis Ruhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. In Kenya, tensions between the government and the opposition continue to climb in the wake of Raila Odinga's self-inauguration. And French President Emmanuel Macron and Senegal's President Macky Sall met today ahead of a global gathering on education in Dakar. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The U.S. State Department announced today it would enact restrictions on arms transfers to South Sudan. The arms restrictions will go into effect immediately. Ayen Dieng Bor has more from Washington.
Paul Sutphen, the State Department's senior advisor to the Office of the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, says this unilateral approach will restrict the flow of deadly arms from finding their way into South Sudan, whether they be intended for government or rebel forces.
What we're trying to do is restrict the flow of lethal material into South Sudan for all parties. And it's not targeted against a particular party, the action we're taking. And we want all the neighbors that you mentioned, all the countries in the region, those other countries that sell a lot of arms, to stop selling those arms or stop into South Sudan, and that's why we want to pursue the multilateral embargo at the United Nations.
In 2016, the Obama administration tried to convince the UN Security Council to approve an arms embargo on South Sudan, but it was not approved. Sutphin says the announcement is part of a series of steps to impose consequences on those who use violence to advance a political agenda. The restriction is enacted through the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, or ITAR, a set of U.S. laws that regulate the export and import of defense-related articles and services.
This is an action we can take with our law for people who require licenses from the United States to sell arms and material.
Companies and entities seeking a license to export defense materials to South Sudan will be denied under the new restrictions. This includes American manufacturers or a company that uses American parts that are controlled under the ITAR, according to Sutphin. U.S. law requires companies, entities, or manufacturers seeking to export controlled products to register with the Directorate of Defense Trade Controls, an office in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs at the Department of State. The law also requires an approval of an export license for all exports of a U.S.-controlled defense article or service, according to a State Department official. The U.S. arms restriction will not directly affect the continuing flow of weapons into South Sudan from its neighboring countries. Adama Dieng, the U.N. Secretary General's Special Advisor for the Prevention of Genocide, confirmed Monday that weapons continue to flow into South Sudan through Kenya and Uganda.
My view is that the situation in South Sudan can't be treated as business as usual, given the magnitude of killings, displacement, and humanitarian crisis. It is about time that punitive measures were applied toward those who impede path to peace.
Sutphin says the State Department hopes the U.S. trade restriction will encourage others, including the African Union and the regional bloc IGAD, to take similar measures.
We need to take a broader approach on this. We need to impose consequences to those parties, including the government, including the main armed opposition group, who have violated their commitment to stop fighting multiple times since they signed it on 21st of December.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley told the U.N. Security Council last week an arms embargo could slow the violence and the flow of arms ammunition to South Sudan. The U.S. arms restriction was enacted just as the second phase of the High-Level Revitalization Forum, an initiative aimed at revitalizing the 2015 peace deal, gets underway Monday in Addis Ababa. Sutphin, who will be at the talks in Ethiopia, says he hopes the arms restriction will send a clear message to the warring parties who have repeatedly violated ceasefire agreements since conflict erupted.
And I think issue number one on the agenda has to be taking the cessation of hostilities and really making it work, stopping the suffering and violence that have racked Sudan, South Sudan, and have sort of injured and killed so many people there. So that is number one on the agenda.
Since the conflict began in December 2013, South Sudan's warring parties have violated 8 different ceasefire agreements, according to the U.S. Institute of Peace. Ayan Dengbior, for VOA News, Washington.
The South Sudan conflict has displaced a third of its population, and the United Nations warns the situation is getting worse. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is trying to overcome a funding shortfall by appealing for more than $3 billion in aid for South Sudan refugees. VOA's Ruben Chama reports from Nairobi.
Filippo Grandi, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, says the agency needs $1.5 billion to support South Sudanese refugees sheltering in neighboring countries. And he says it needs an additional $1.7 billion for those in need inside the country.
We launched this appeal in a context of, unfortunately, yet to be reached peace, peace that has not been reached yet. I would even say of multiple failures, a context of multiple failures to reach peace. For us who deal directly with the people that suffer the consequences of these failures, each one of them is a blow to their hopes, is a missed opportunity to give them a better future.
With the conflict now in its fifth year, nearly 2.5 million South Sudanese have fled to Uganda, Kenya, Sudan, Ethiopia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Central African Republic. Grandi said Thursday in Nairobi that if violence doesn't ease this year, there will be more than 3 million refugees.
So we're talking here about half of the population perhaps soon not living anymore in their homes. This is a proportion that I think in no other country we have seen. And 85% are women and children, so of course are exposed to particular risks and carry very acute vulnerabilities, violence against women, forced recruitment of children.
The UN Refugee Agency says women have reported they have been raped and assaulted, their husbands killed, and their children abducted as they fled their homes. Soldiers on all sides also target aid workers in South Sudan. Mark Lowcock is the head of the UN Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator.
We remain deeply concerned and shocked at the very difficult situation that the international community and the local aid workers are facing as they try to reduce the suffering of people inside South Sudan. Last year, as you all know, 28 aid workers were killed in the line of duty as a result of deliberate acts by men with guns. And hundreds of aid workers, 650 in more than 50 incidents, were forced to relocate.
He welcomes South Sudanese leader Salva Kiir's recent decision to allow humanitarian organizations to operate freely in the world's youngest nation. Lowcock says it is urgent that the order be implemented right away. Humanitarian needs in South Sudan continue to escalate at an alarming rate. Despite this, the UN's funding for the refugee crisis remains low, with only 33% of the required funds received in 2017. After visiting several refugee camps in East Africa, the UN High Commissioner and his delegation had this message to the international community.
My very strong impression, people are losing hope. When I met somebody of my age in Arua district in Uganda earlier this week, and he told me, I've been a refugee four times in a lifetime. This is too much. We cannot accept this. This is what needs to be addressed.
Conflict and insecurity has now forcibly displaced 1 in 3 of the country's population, either within South Sudan or across its borders. Inside the country, some 7 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past.
Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Looking for something? Headline news? Interviews? Analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Greetings and happy Friday to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Thanks for tuning in this evening. Welcome to the sunny side of sports.
Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
The sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports.
The sunny side of sports show.
Great show, bro. This is sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports
right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Let's kick off in Casablanca, where Morocco will host Nigeria in Sunday's African Nations Championship football final. Our VOA listeners will remember this is for locally based players in Africa. Reporter Samson Omale has a preview of the final, as well as other African football news. Good evening, Samson.
Good evening to you, Sonny. Nigeria will look to upset host Morocco in the 2018 African Nations Championship final, set for the start Mohamed V in Casablanca on Sunday evening. The Atlas Lions and the Super Eagles are bidding to become the fourth different winners of the CHAN, joining the honors board of DR Congo, who were champions in 2009 and 2016, Tunisia in 2014, and Libya in 2015. Both sides came through the semifinals on Wednesday evening, where Morocco needed extra time to overcome a resilient Libya 3-1 in their North African derby in Casablanca, while Nigeria edged Sudan 1-0 in a hard-fought clash in Marrakesh. Kenyan Premier League 2018 season is set for kick-off this weekend, with two matches planned for live television broadcast. A double-header at Nakuru's Afra Stadium pitting Ulinzi Stars against Zoo FC and Postal Rangers versus AFC Leopards will be beamed live on yet-to-be-announced broadcaster on Saturday. Elsewhere in East Africa, Ugandan football fans will have an opportunity to see the FIFA World Cup trophy as it will be displayed for 2 days at the Lugungo Stadium. Trophy, which will be received by Ugandan government officials or the president on March the 5th, will be available for the rest of Ugandans to view inside Lugungo Cricket Oval in Kampala. And staying with football news, a host of African players were involved in various transfers on deadline day. Senegalese striker Demba Ba makes his Turkish league return after joining Göztepe from Chinese Super League side Shanghai Shenhua. Demba Ba scored 29 goals in 37 appearances for the Chinese club. club. Ghana international Andre Ayew joined English Premier League side Swansea City from West Ham United for a club record fee. La Liga side UD Las Palmas announced the double signing of Nigerian internationals Ogenekaro Etebo and Emmanuel Emineke on deadline day. Algerian international striker Islam Slimani completed a loan move to Newcastle United from Leicester City until the end of the season. While Senegal forward Homer Babacar switched Serie A sides after joining U.S. Sassuolo from ACF Fiorentina in a swap deal for Diego Falensini. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria.
Thanks, Samson, and have a nice weekend. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Samson Omale mentioned the Kenyan Premier Football League in his report. Well, let's give a Sunny Side of Sports birthday salute to one of our loyal VOA listeners in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Happy 42nd birthday to Vincent Maloba, the beat cop of the Sunny Side of Sports. Vincent is a constable in the Kenya Police Department's Diplomats Protection Unit. And in terms of protection, I always feel safer and happier when I know Vincent is tuning in to the show. And on that note, Vincent says he's listening to the Sunny Side of Sports this evening on 107.5 FM, the VOA's 24/7 FM affiliate in the Kenyan capital. Happy birthday to Vincent Maloba, the beat cop of the Sunny Side of Sports. Here in the United States, the big sporting event this weekend is the National Football League's 52nd Super Bowl championship game in Minneapolis, Minnesota. My VOA colleague Jim Stevenson has a super preview for us, as well as a look back at Roger Federer's record-extending 20th Grand Slam tennis title earlier this week.
We're in the final few days before Super Bowl 52 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's a rematch of Super Bowl 39 between the defending champion New England Patriots and the Philadelphia Eagles. While the five-time champion Patriots have a lot of Super Bowl experience, Eagles coach Tom Pederson has players he's looking to for leadership.
Of course, it's been a while since the Eagles have been there, but you know, we do have a couple players on this team that have been there just as early as last season. You know, we can lean on those guys, obviously, and some of the experiences that some of our other players have been to the Super Bowl and all that.
No matter how many times he has won, New England quarterback Tom Brady knows how special this run with the Patriots has been.
Could never imagine getting, you know, the kind of, team achievements we've done and had. I mean, I don't think anyone can ever take those for granted. These are pretty amazing times for all of us.
Eagles quarterback Nick Foles once had the NFL's highest passer rating in 2013, and he tied the record for most touchdown passes in a single game with 7. But his long journey to his first Super Bowl was anything but glamorous.
There was bumps in the road, but you were able to overcome them with, you know, the people that are around you, the people that believe in you and love you. I mean, that's a special thing, and that's where, in this moment, is something I reflect on.
And Eagles coach Tom Pederson hopes his players have fun.
I want them to, you know, let their personalities show. Let them have fun. I mean, enjoy the moment. This is why we coach and play, is for these opportunities and these moments right here.
Super Bowl 52 is this Sunday, February 4th. Roger Federer has proven he's the ageless wonder of the tennis courts. The Swiss great, at the tender age of 36, has again won the Australian Open, just as he did last year. This year, he topped Marin Cilic of Croatia in the final, 6-2, 6-7, 6-3, 3-6, 6-1.
It's about living the emotions that I went through tonight again at the trophy ceremony, going through a tough roller coaster match. You know, five-setter against Cilic, who's a great player, and then getting number 6 here, number 20 overall. It's just a very special moment, defending my title from last year, that, you know, sort of the fairy tale continues. That's what stands out for me.
As Roger mentioned, it was his 20th overall major title, and it seems a bit of a distraction.
I was not allowed to think of it going into the match, because that's exactly when things go bad, you know, when you think too far ahead, and I think that's what was a tricky one tonight. All day I was thinking, how would I feel if I won it? How would I feel if I lost it? I'm so close now, yet so far. And I think it was going through the whole match like this. So I've had these moments in the past, but maybe never as extreme as tonight. So, you know, getting to 20 is obviously very, very special, no doubt.
It was a hot road to the final, literally. As Cilic explains, only to find the final would be an indoor match.
It was difficult with conditions. You know, throughout the tournament, I played all my matches outdoors and, you know, preparing for a hot day, 38 degrees, and then first match for the final to play with the roof closed. It's difficult, and I have to say that that decision could have been different.
Federer was a little surprised as well by the closed roof.
At the end, it's not my decision. You know, they kept me posted along the way. I was surprised to hear that they had the heat rule in place for a night match. I never heard of that before, so when I arrived to the courts, I was totally ready to play outdoors, and then they told me they're thinking, or they think that it will probably be indoor. And then they kept me posted along the way, and half an hour before we got the word that, okay, it's going to be indoors. And for me, it didn't change any in the preparation, to be honest. I was ready for either.
Although he didn't win, Cilic was happy with his experience.
Beating Rafa and reaching here, a final, which is definitely amazing. And looking at my own game, I think I improved a lot. I'm playing great tennis, and that's really exciting for me for this 2018.
And Federer goes home with an old friend.
I felt like it was very fitting, you know, to rather than saying, like, I'm bringing the trophy, I'm bringing Norman along. You know, it's like a friend now. We got to know each other. So it was just funny last year. I don't know if I'll do it again this year, but sure, Norman has a special place for us anyway, and it's great to be sitting with him here tonight, right now.
After 6 years, Caroline Wozniacki of Denmark is once again the world's top women's tennis player with her first career major title at the Australian Open.
Obviously, that's very special. I think being a new Grand Slam champion and world number one sounds pretty good. So I'm very excited for that, and it's a dream come true.
Wozniacki was becoming concerned she couldn't close out the win quickly over Simona Halep of Romania.
I had opportunities to go 3-0 and 4-1, and I didn't take them, and she was playing really well, and I was thinking, you know, it looks like it may not be my day, but I was never really nervous at that point. I was just going to go out there and give it my all and swing for it, and I was playing aggressively. I think I played well and could have gone either way today.
But Halep just ran out of energy in the heat of the moment and heat from the sun.
After the first set, I just was out. I don't know what happened. No energy, no power, but then I came back in the third set, but when I had to serve for 5-3, the gas was gone.
Halep got over her disappointment by the time she spoke with the media.
I can still smile. It's fine. I cried, but now I'm smiling. It's just a tennis match in the end, but yeah, I'm really sad I couldn't win it.
Like Roger Federer, Wozniacki has a new special friend.
You know, being here tonight as a Grand Slam champion, Australian Open champion, it's very special. Daphne here is it's going home with me tonight, and I'll be cuddling with her, so yeah.
And thanks to my VOA colleague, Jim Stevenson, for that spicy sports report. I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. The Super Bowl is not the only big sporting event taking place in the United States this weekend. One of the country's most prestigious indoor athletics meets, the Millrose Games, will take place in New York City on Saturday. Reporter Jonah Haskell has more details for us.
This February, as the world's attention turns towards South Korea and winter sports, track athletes from around the world are gathering in New York City for one of the premier indoor track events in the world, the Millrose Games. The 111th iteration of one of the most prestigious events in indoor track will take place on Saturday, February 3rd, at the Fort Washington Armory in northern Manhattan. Along with many of the United States' top high school and college athletes, some of the world's top long-distance runners, sprinters, hurdlers, long jumpers, and pole vaulters, to name just a few of the events, will be competing this weekend as they try to add to the game's already rich history. The Millrose games trace their origin to 1908, when employees of the John Wanamaker Department Store formed an athletic and recreational club called the Millrose Athletic Association. The first version of the games were held that same year, and by 1914, after selling out the original venue the year before, they moved to the most famous arena in the world, Madison Square Garden. The games would remain at the Garden for the next 97 years, during which time numerous high school, collegiate, American, and world records were broken. The great Carl Lewis demolished the world indoor long jump record at the Millrose Games in 1984, and later that year went on to win 4 gold medals, including in long jump, at the Summer Olympics in Los Angeles. And while other events like long jump have always been part of the games, the marquee event has long been the Wanamaker Mile. Named for a former owner of the Wanamaker department store, Rodman Wanamaker, the event actually began as a mile-and-a-half race, first held at the 9th Millrose Games in 1916. But it was later reduced to a flat mile in 1926. Since then, it has been held 81 times and been won by 44 different men. Former world champion distance runner Eamon Coghlan of Ireland became synonymous with the event, as he won it 7 different times in the late 70s and 80s. His record was eclipsed, though, in 2010, when Kenyan-born American Bernard Laggett won his 8th Wanamaker Mile. Following its heyday in the mid to late 20th century, the popularity of the Millrose Games dwindled, as indoor track itself lost recognition around the world. Long from the days of packing Madison Square Garden with 18,000 screaming fans, the 2010 Games only drew around 9,000 fans. This prompted the New York Roadrunners, the same nonprofit organization that operates the New York Marathon, to move the events uptown to the Armory, a smaller, more feasible location. But the move hasn't dampened the quality or ferocity of the competition. Last year's Wanamaker Mile winner Eric Jenkins shocked the field by taking the gold.
Coming down the stretch, Eric Jenkins looking for his first Wanamaker Mile. Jenkins wins it.
In recent years, Matt Centrowitz Jr., the American gold medalist in the 1500 meters at the 2016 Olympics in Rio, set the Wanamaker Mile record, finishing in 3 minutes, 50.63 seconds. While Centrowitz won't be running this year, his biggest rival, Nick Willis of New Zealand, will be in attendance. While he has managed both bronze and silver Olympic medals in the 1500 meters, Willis has gone 0-for-5 in the Wanamaker Mile in his career, finishing either second or third every time. With Centrowitz out of the way this year, he'll be looking to seize the moment. And also running in this year's Wanamaker Mile will be Josh Kerr, who's currently the U.S. Collegiate Champion in both indoor and outdoor mile. Adding star power in other events are American Olympian and former world champion Lolo Jones, who will compete in the 60-meter hurdles, and Jamaican Olympic gold medalist Asafa Powell will run as well. Powell is the current world record holder in the 100-yard dash, topping Usain Bolt with a time of 9.07 seconds. For the Sunny Side of Sports, I'm Jonah Haskell in New York. Now back to Sonny Young in Washington.
Thanks, Jonah. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Let's give another Sunny Side of Sports salute to Dan Friedel, who hosted the show on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday this week. With the Winter Olympics officially opening February 9th, Dan had a chance to chat with American sports journalist Christine Brennan, who's packing her bags for Pyeongchang and coverage of her 18th Olympics. Let's listen in now to the final part of their conversation. Here's Dan.
Why don't you give our listeners two storylines that you're excited to follow as the games get going in February?
Well, that's a great thought, and probably there could be a lot more than two, but one, I'll stick with women's ice hockey for a moment because, of course, the men, kind of a corollary, the men will not be the NHL this time, and that's going to be maybe kind of fun because you're going to see, for the United States, for example, you're going to see, and other countries, Canada as well, you're going to see younger, minor league hockey players or college players, and that it kind of harkens back to 1980. Not going to be a, do you believe in miracles, miracle on ice, you're just never going to have that happen again. But it's, you know, you're going to have the Russians be favored because of their very strong, their pro league. But you're going to have a younger and more, you know, not amateurs by any means, but college age or minor league in that sense, and fresher, younger faces. So in the men's side, the women's side, it's going to be fascinating to watch the U.S. team, and here's why. In the Me Too movement and in all the conversation we're having about equality for women in this country after the election of Donald Trump and what happened last year, and now this year, we're, of course, having the conversation about women's rights and equality and equal pay, et cetera. Well, the U.S. women's ice hockey team back in March really kicked the story off, and many probably don't remember or don't know, but they were threatened to boycott the World Championships for it, to get better pay, not necessarily equal pay, it's the NHL that they're going against, but better travel, better conditions, better treatment all the way around financially and other from the Hockey Federation, the U.S. National Governing Body for Hockey, because they were getting table scraps compared to the men. And the women did threaten a boycott and did get a new contract, and it is much better. And so they fought that battle. And that's very much in keeping with the conversation we're all having now around whether it's Hollywood or politics or business or what have you. And so I find that fascinating. And then, of course, on the field of play, on the ice, in the rink, U.S. and Canada are 1-2, 2-1, and Canada's won the last couple times, and the U.S. so almost had it 4 years ago in Sochi and lost in the overtime after a heartbreaking last-second goal by Canada to tie it. And heartbreaking for the U.S., great for Canada. And so now the U.S. really, really wants that gold back, as, of course, you would imagine. And I fully imagine a U.S.-Canada gold medal match at the end of the games in women's hockey. It's going to be one of the highlights of the games, I think. And then I'll be around figure skating a lot, as you know, and always drama, always fascinating. In addition to the North Korean pair, assuming they're there, which, again, we'll assume nothing until it happens, but I hope they are. I think the women's competition in figure skating is going to be fascinating with two Russians right at the top, Evgenia Medvedeva and her training mate, about 3 years younger, 15-year-old Elena Zagitova. So we call her Zag, and we call Medvedeva Med, for those who have trouble with the pronunciations or the names. And they will be 1-2 probably in the women's competition. Medvedeva was at an undefeated streak of 2 years until beaten by her training mate just a couple weeks ago at the European Championships. On the men's side, it's all about the quad. Nathan Chen, 18 years old from the United States, is planning to do 5 quads in his long program. First ever person on earth, male, female, to ever do 5 quads in a long program. He did it last year at the U.S. Nationals in 2017, came back in 2018 in January to do that, and now he will... He is certainly a medal favorite of several Japanese skaters as well, including Yuzuru Hanyu, the reigning Olympic gold medalist coming back from an injury, Shomo Una, his countryman, and quite a few others from around the world doing 4 or 5 quads in the long program. It is going to be a jump fest, the likes of which we have never seen, and that ice is very slippery as they're landing on a quarter-inch blade of steel. But these young men are just unbelievable jumpers, having taken figure skating to an athletic high and plateau that we never would have envisioned. And that is going to be fascinating to watch how that plays out and who wins the gold and silver and bronze in the men's competition.
That's American sports journalist Christine Brennan, who will be traveling to South Korea for coverage of her 18th Olympics. And Christine was talking with Dan Friedel. I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
In National Basketball Association news, Blake Griffin has made a successful debut with the Detroit Pistons. Griffin had 24 points and 10 rebounds Thursday night to help power the Pistons to a 104-102 victory over the visiting Memphis Grizzlies. The Pistons acquired Griffin from the Los Angeles Clippers earlier this week in a blockbuster trade. Speaking after the game, Griffin said, and I quote, "I wanted to just come out and play hard, being very limited in my knowledge of our offense." In other NBA results, in an all-Texas matchup, the Houston Rockets scored a 102-91 road victory over the San Antonio Spurs
James Harden, still sporting my favorite beard in basketball, led the Rockets once again with 28 points and 11 assists. Our Voice of America basketball fans will remember Harden recently put his name in the NBA record books by becoming the first player to have a triple-double while scoring 60 points in one game. Here in Washington, my favorite NBA team, the Washington Wizards, defeated the visiting Toronto Raptors 122-119. It was Washington's third consecutive victory without their all-star point guard, John Wall, who had knee surgery earlier this week and is not expected back on the court until mid-March at the earliest. Bradley Beal led the way for the Wizards with 27 points. Beal will be the Wizards' representative in the All-Star Game, the NBA All-Star Game, on February 18th in Los Angeles, California. More All-Star news. Miami Heat guard Goran Dragic has been named by NBA Commissioner Adam Silver as an injury replacement for the February 18th All-Star Game. The 31-year-old Slovenian guard will replace Cleveland Cavaliers forward Kevin Love, who recently broke his left hand in a game. And that wraps up the February 2nd edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer Nelson Lopes. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA Sonny Young in Washington. Have a nice weekend, everyone. And that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In his first State of the Union address, President Donald Trump spoke about rebuilding America's strength and confidence at home and restoring its strength and standing abroad. The president stressed the importance of a strong military. Around the world, he observed, we face rogue regimes, terrorist groups, and rivals like China and Russia that challenge our interests, our economy, and our values. In confronting these horrible dangers, we know that weakness is the surest path to conflict, and unmatched power is the surest means to our true and great defense. President Trump highlighted recent military success in the fight against ISIS.
1 year later, I am proud to report that the coalition to defeat ISIS has liberated very close to 100% of the territory just recently held by these killers in Iraq and in Syria and in other locations as well. But there is much more work to be done. We will continue our fight until ISIS is defeated.
In the fight against terrorism, it is at times necessary to detain and question terrorists. President Trump stressed that terrorists are unlawful enemy combatants, and when captured overseas, they should be treated like the terrorists they are. To that end, the military detention facility at Guantanamo Bay will remain open. The U.S. continues to restore clarity about its adversaries, said President Trump.
When the people of Iran rose up against the crimes of their corrupt dictatorship, I did not stay silent. America stands with the people of Iran in their courageous struggle for freedom.
The U.S. has also imposed tough sanctions on the communist and socialist dictatorships in Cuba and Venezuela. But no regime has oppressed its own citizens more totally or brutally than North Korea, said President Trump.
North Korea's reckless pursuit of nuclear missiles could very soon threaten our homeland. We are waging a campaign of maximum pressure to prevent that from ever happening. Past experience has taught us that complacency and concessions only invite aggression and provocation.
America will continue to defend its interests and demonstrate its values as it pursues peace through strength.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Steve Miller reporting. Representative Adam Schiff, a key Democratic U.S. congressman, is blasting the Republican memo that's likely to be released soon on the Russia investigation.
We now know from the FBI that when they finally got a chance to look at it, that the memo is seriously misleading because it omits very material information and has deep factual inaccuracies.
Multiple news sources are reporting that President Donald Trump has approved the declassification of the memo and is sending it back to the House Intelligence Committee. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is visiting Latin American countries with a warning that China and Russia are assuming alarming roles in the region, and he is urging authorities in Latin America to work with the United States instead.
While this trade has brought benefits, the unfair trading practices used by many Chinese have also harmed these countries' manufacturing sectors, generating unemployment and lowering wages for workers.
After Mexico, Tillerson has talks in Argentina, Peru, and Colombia with a final stop in Jamaica on February 7th. U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis said Friday that the United States has no evidence that the Syrian government recently used deadly sarin nerve gas on its citizens, but is looking into reporting of its use from people on the ground. Syria has denied using illegal chemicals. Mattis said the Syrian government has weaponized and used chlorine gas in the Syrian civil war, and that the U.S. is even more concerned about the possibility of sarin use. The colorless toxin can cause respiratory failure, leading to death. Follow Voice of America on social media sites for pictures, videos, stories, and more. This is VOA News. Kenyan lawyer Magina Maguna is arrested for taking part in an opposition leader Raila Odinga swearing-in ceremony. Julian Satterthwaite has more.
Maguna's arrest is the second since the inauguration. On Wednesday, the opposition lawyer who administered Odinga's oath at the ceremony was also arrested. The government has called the alternative inauguration an illegal act. Three private channels who covered the swearing-in ceremony remain off-air on government orders, despite a court order that they be allowed to resume broadcasting. Odinga has accused the government of suspending the constitution by attacking the media. The police have declined to comment on the latest arrest.
That was reporter Julian Satterthwaite. The UN Refugee Agency says thousands of Rohingya refugees in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, face mudslides, floods, disease, and other dangers from upcoming monsoon season. Lisa Schlein has that story from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
UN aid agencies are making emergency preparations to mitigate and avert the worst impacts from the upcoming monsoon season. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Andrei Mihecic says at least 100,000 refugees could be in grave danger from landslides and floods. The UNHCR says work will proceed to level some of the steep hills to reduce the risk of landslides. It says some families living in the most precarious parts of the camp will be moved to safer areas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani alleged Friday Taliban insurgents fighting the government in Kabul are using Pakistan as a headquarters and demanded the neighboring country take immediate action against them. Martin Sekris reports.
The charges underscore intensifying bilateral tensions in the wake of recent deadly attacks in the Afghan capital that killed nearly 140 people, including four Americans. In a nationally televised speech, Ghani claimed 11 suspects arrested in connection with the violence have revealed the identities of the perpetrators and their locations. Ghani's hard-hitting speech Friday came as a high-level Pakistani delegation is set to travel to Afghanistan on Saturday to discuss mutual security, economic, and trade cooperation. Martin Sekras, VOA News.
A group of advocates for greater leadership roles for women in the Catholic Church says the Vatican has refused to let former Irish President Mary McAleese to participate in an annual event marking International Women's Day and that organizers are taking the event elsewhere. A Greek court rejected the extradition request for the first of nine suspects, left-wing militants from Turkey, who were arrested in November. The nine suspects were arrested for alleged links to the revolutionary